Guardian Unlimited.
Hi, this is the Guardian Science Podcast. I'm your host, Alok Jha, and this is the show for the 4th of September. I'm sitting here in the pod with the Guardian's Ian Sample and James Randerson.
Hello.
And we've also got the ever-reliable Helen O'Brien from Imperial College.
Hello.
We're going to be talking about a new TV programme that wants to smash the fuddy-duddy image of science. We've got an exclusive interview with British astronaut Piers Sellers, and I know you've been waiting for this. There's a report from a mountain in Chile. Now, if you think you've heard that last item before, think again. You can email us at science@guardian.co.uk or send us a blog entry at blogs.guardian.co.uk/podcasts or Skype us at GU_studio. We've talked a lot on this show before about how interested people are, or in fact aren't, about science. We've also talked about how we think things could change. Someone who shares our ideas, I hope, is Adam Rutherford. He's a geneticist by training and one of the three Men in White, a new Channel 4 TV programme that uses science to solve problems sent in by viewers. The first show went out on Sunday, and amongst other things, Adam and his fellow Men in White helped make a house appear more haunted and built a bike that you could also use on water. Here's a clip from the programme.
Many duds are a dance floor menace.
They're going to hitch me up.
But finally, after drawing upon all their science skills, the Men in White think they've cracked it. Cue the music.
We're going to try... Oh, what was that? Oh, 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 oh.
It might not be a pretty sight, but at least he's dancing in time. Kind of.
Adam, thanks for joining us here. Can you just quickly explain what on earth was going on in that clip?
Well, the clip you just played was a son writing in complaining that his dad is a bloody awful dancer. And Basil, one of the other Men in White, and Jem built a circuit where it registered the peaks in the music, so the beats, and stimulated an electric shock to four places on his body, his arms. And
what was the idea? That these electric shocks would sort of force him to move his arms about in time?
Yeah, what it actually did was
cause him a lot of pain, it seems.
Quite a lot of pain. There was a smell of bacon in the studio at the time, not sure what that was. So it did have an effect on his dance floor moves. Not sure we really cured the problem there, but it was really funny to watch.
Okay, so tell me why this programme's sort of being made now. I mean, what's your sort of motivation behind it?
We want to dispel the myth about scientists being old fuddy-duddies. Right? Yeah, there's a lot of science on TV. There's a lot of bad science on TV. Most of it is presented by very professional and very serious scientists, people like Lord Winston. They're very good, but they're also very old, and they're very old, white, middle-class men. I know a lot of scientists. You know a lot of scientists. Helen here is a scientist. None of us are old, white, middle-class men. We want to make science, I'm loath to say this, but more fun.
Don't take this the wrong way, but it is sort of being wacky and crazy about science the way to get people sort of interested. I mean, people aren't doing science because they think it's boring, but do you think going the other way completely is, you know, is really the right thing?
Well, I hope so.
Good. Helen, what do you think? I mean, you've seen a clip there. As a scientist, give us your quick verdict on it.
Well, it was certainly fun, but I'm not sure how science-y it really was. Well,
I think that's a fair comment. I mean, the difference between us and other, as you say, wacky science programmes out there is that we are credible. At least that's what we're meant to be.
So you don't make things up then, like certain Sky programmes?
No, there is no fakery, as of the Brainiac, as featured on this podcast a couple of weeks ago. And there's a good difference there as well. And they're presented by that tiny man from Top Gear. And we're presented by... I do have a PhD in genetics.
You do.
I work at Nature, which is a pretty serious science journal. Basil has a PhD in quantum chaos. I don't even know what that is.
No, I don't think he does he?
And Jem is the most extraordinary engineer who can build anything out of anything.
Well, excellent. Listen, what we did was to go out and try and find some more people to come up with questions for you. Here's what they had to say.
Hello, Adam. My name's Dave, and I've got a really, really serious problem. Can I swear during this?
Yeah.
Every time I go out and have a fucking drink with my mate, and he's had, like, three or four pints, because he's of Irish descent, and he meets somebody who actually is from Ireland, he starts talking like a fucking Irishman. And it's a concern. Adam, for fuck's sake, help me find the solution, because it's driving me fucking mad.
Adam, have you got a solution?
Yeah, this guy, I refuse to help this man. He's a lazy bigot and a racist. And if he chooses his friends that annoy him so much when he goes out to drink...
Hang on, wait. You can't, you know, maybe he needs the help then. What would you do?
What would I do to him?
Can't you build something
well,
or help him?
If I weren't a pacifist, I'd give him a slap for being such a racist. How's that, Dave, you sweary bastard?
Have we got any more? Here's another question for you.
Hi, Adam. My name is Andrea. I have one problem. I live in London and I'm a dancer. And I really love opportunities here, but my problem is that people here doesn't care of each other. They just want to make money. And I don't like the atmosphere. I really want to build some relationships with them. And this will make me sad. Could you give me some solution?
Go on, Adam. Help a Czech in distress.
Most of the problems that we dealt with on the show tended to have a sort of engineering or scientific basis, but this woman sounds like she's actually quite depressed.
Maybe she's
a
dating agency, online dating agency.
Yeah, I think she should.
Like
come on,
you seek professional help. Maybe get out there. I mean, there's no science involved.
A minute. Be a bit more creative. You could probably help her with some nice bit of psychology or something, can't you?
Yeah, well, she sounds like she needs some lithium to me.
Okay. All right, I tell you what, we'll leave that there. Adam, when's the show on? Tell us when the show's on.
So it's on Sundays for the next 6 weeks on Channel 4 at 5:45.
Okay, Adam, well, thanks very much. Thanks very much for coming today, actually, as well, considering you were supposed to be on Richard and Judy. Listen, we're very pleased that you chose us over them. This is doing wonders to your credibility, Adam.
Yeah,
thanks a lot.
Thanks, guys.
The Space Shuttle Atlantis is poised to launch, weather permitting, from Cape Canaveral in Florida this week. Its job is to deliver parts in a bid to restart the building of the International Space Station, something that's been on hold since the Columbia accident more than 3.5 years ago. It's a momentous mission that could see the Space Shuttle back on track for its few remaining years. I spoke to Piers Sellers, the British-born astronaut who carried out some of the most epic spacewalks and the last mission in Discovery last month. And I asked him about some of the problems that NASA has been having with the shuttle in recent years. I began by asking him whether he was relieved or not when their Discovery landed safely last month.
All of us had the same, thought in mind. We all went to the front of Discovery. We walked underneath the bird. We looked up at the nose, and then we all walked back carefully looking at the bottom tiles all the way down the length of Discovery and looked along the leading edges of the wings, and there was no damage at all. It was the cleanest shuttle they've ever seen down there at Kennedy, and that's the good news, that all the fixes they'd put in on the tank seem to have worked, and we now have a much safer shuttle.
So is the shuttle back on track now?
It is, and that's the main good news story, is that we're back to where we should be. We're back to where we were before Columbia.
On the mission that you just come back from, off Discovery, you did quite an epic spacewalk. We did a lot. There was a lot of coverage in the newspapers here about that. Can you tell us what it's like to floating up space?
We did three. It was like commuting after a while. Spacewalks are they're really hard work, and it's a little bit gladiatorial. You have to crank yourself up, pull on all this equipment, and then wait in a small dark room while they pump all the air out. Then you jump out into the sunlight and work your socks off
with nothing
for 7 hours.
You.
With nothing underneath you.
How do you get used to that?
That is extraordinary. It's the first time I ever did it. I found the whole experience overwhelming for a couple of minutes. I mean, you find yourself dropping out of the airlock, and you find yourself underneath this huge ship, gigantic gleaming machine that's hurtling around the planet about 5 miles a second. And there's the Earth below you, whizzing by, 200 miles below you. And the sky is black, and the sun is a brilliant burning white. I mean, just so bright it burns your eyes. And everything looks like it's glowing because the light is so bright. It's an extraordinary alien place.
Is it quite exhausting, the actual spacewalk?
Yeah, it's tiring. The suit is pressurized, so it resists all your movements. So, for example, when you curl your fingers to make a fist in your glove, because of the pressure in the glove, it makes your fingers want to straighten out again. Like you're trying to bend a balloon, a party balloon. Well, that's true for every component on a spacesuit.
So you have to constantly be tensing.
You're constantly fighting the suit to get any work done.
You famously lost a spanner up there.
How
did that happen?
It was a spatula.
A spatula.
Well, everything is floating around, So you have to tether everything with the systems of tether hooks and wires and whatnot. And you've got to keep all this stuff under control.
Did you get any ribbing from your fellow astronauts?
Let me tell you, I'm lying back in my office here talking to you, and above my head there's a huge globe hanging from the ceiling, and it's got a circle of spatulas spinning around it. Yeah, so I got this kind of mobile, you know, above my head, a bit of mobile art with all these spatulas circling around for me. They're not going to let me forget.
On to the space tourism, finally. Can you give us a sense of how difficult people might find this? And because people are quite excited about it. I'm quite excited. I'd like
I think space tourism is a great idea. Whenever I go, I always say, gosh, I wish I could take everybody else with me so they could see this. This is so beautiful to see the whole planet and to, you know, go quietly around the whole planet in 100 minutes. It's marvelous. Unbeatable. So thoroughly recommended. I want all my friends and family to go. Now, having said that, it's difficult to get into orbit, and it's difficult to get back. And we've got to kind of distinguish between the different kinds of space travel. There's the space adventures where they're going to take off and go up 60 miles, you know, just above the atmosphere, and then fall back down again. So you get about 15 minutes of weightlessness. Now, that's cool, and people, I think, will be paying about $100,000 each to do that, and that'll be a nice experience. You will see the black sky and all that. But it takes 50 times the energy to get into orbit compared to doing that. And also, by the way, you have to get rid of that energy when you come back in during entry, so that's why entry is dangerous too. I think you'll see lots of people doing these suborbital lobs over the next 10 years if they get, you know, all the problems ironed out. But I don't think you'll see much orbital tourism for quite a while. It's just too expensive.
I must say, I'm going to be first in line for any space tourism. Adam, do you reckon the Men in White are going to do a show from space at some point? Or try to get into space? You must be able to build something.
Well, you know, he outlined the problem there, really, which is the expensive bit in space travel is getting out of the orbit, right? It's getting out of the atmosphere. Men in White tend to come up with fairly preposterous and not very practicable solutions. But I seem to remember there's quite a large research project to do the space elevator. That is perfect Men in White territory.
Well, I'll look forward to seeing that. You can hear actually more of an interview with Piers in this week's Science Podcast Extra, which you can download from the website guardian.co.uk/science/podcasts. The News Jam is up next. Okay, so this is the News Jam, where we're going to go through our favourite stories of the week. Helen and Adam are both here. And we've got Ben on the line, Ben Goldacre as well, who does our Bad Science column. Thanks for joining us. I'm going to ask you first about one of the stories this week, which is that the MHRA, which is the government's regulatory body that licenses medicines and that kind of thing, is thinking of licensing homeopathic remedies.
Yeah, well, I mean, they're not just talking about it, they've done it. And they walked it through in a bit of a hurry, actually. The statutory instrument was laid before Parliament 2 or 3 days before the recess, so there wasn't time for it to have adequate scrutiny.
Can you tell me what actually they've done?
You could argue it's not that dramatic. I think what it reflects really is a kind of creeping change towards legitimising alternative therapies that's coming very much from above. So, I mean, the main change is that It means that people are allowed to make claims on the packaging that homeopathic medicines are to be used to treat a particular medical condition.
Right, and they've not been able to do that before.
They were able to do that before only for homeopathic medications that had previous to about 1970
okay.
already had a history of being used in those conditions.
Why does this matter, Ben? I mean, in a sense, you know, if they work for some people, why not?
I've got slightly peculiar views on homeopathy, because I actually think it's a good thing that people use homeopathy, and I think it's a very valuable thing to have. At the same time, I don't think it works any better than placebo, and I think it's misleading and wrong to suggest to people that it does work any better than placebo. I think what's wrong with the MHRA guidelines is that they suggest that by allowing a medication to say that it's there to treat a particular medical problem without any evidence base to say that it can treat that medical problem, you introduce a very sort of peculiar double standard, and it's a double standard that was going to be exploited by the industry. I mean, already there are people from the homeopathy community saying, you know, effectively reading this as official endorsement of homeopathy and saying, you know, homeopathy does work. Now, of course, homeopathy does work in the sense that a placebo works, and a placebo is incredibly effective, and a placebo isn't just about a sugar pill. A placebo is about the whole process of going to see somebody talking through your problems, being taken seriously, and of course time passing will heal a lot of medical problems. So I don't think it's a bad thing that people are taking placebos, but I think it's a bad thing that they're being misled, and particularly misled by the MHRA, which is, after all, a very serious and august governmental regulatory body. I mean, the MHRA and its predecessors were set up in response to things like, drug disasters like thalidomide, and it's there to regulate safety of medicine. It was set up in response to inappropriate and irresponsible overclaiming by the pharmaceutical industry.
And yet still, there is no scientific evidence to suggest that any of their stuff actually does what it's supposed to do.
You know, I think about this a lot, and I used to care, but it just does. I refuse to get riled by this.
What do you mean
about the use of homeopathy and about it's a terrible thing that an official government body is maybe endorsing it, or maybe endorsing homeopathy or the use of homeopathy to the extent that it can be put on labels. But I refuse to get excited about it nowadays because it's just perpetual and it's there.
Well, I think that, actually, if people want to use these remedies, then they should be able to. But I think the problem comes in is when they choose those over more traditional, real medicines, which have been proven to work. And I think that's where the problem is if the government is actually endorsing them, people will think that they can take those endorsements in the same way that they can take endorsements of real medicine.
Now, we'll leave that one there. That can obviously run around. Ben, thanks for joining us today. I'm sure that we'll read more about this stuff in your column later. James, talk to me about immune cancer cells, or killing cancer cells with the immune system.
Yeah, it's been a good week for gene therapy, or at least a fairly good week. A group has managed to do some gene therapy on immune cells in order to skin cancer, the most dangerous form of skin cancer. Essentially what they do is take the skin cells out, teach them to recognise a molecule on the outside of the cancer cells. They did that by introducing a genetically modified virus and then putting those immune cells back into the people. Now, it's kind of a qualified success because only 2 out of the 17 patients they tried it on are still alive, but those 2 patients seem to be free of the cancer and have been for 18 months. So this is only really...
What did the other 15 die of?
Well, their skin cancer. Hence, a qualified success.
But James, I mean, this isn't the gene therapy breakthrough we've all been sort of looking forward to, is it?
No, quite. What they found in most of the others was that they found that the immune cells did persist and were still around, but obviously weren't good enough to kill off the cancer. So they're obviously at the stage of, well, let's make this better, let's improve it. I mean, it's only the second example of gene therapy that actually works in any way at all. So yeah, I totally agree with you, Adam. It's not exactly the breakthrough we've been looking for.
Okay, one more thing, Pluto, Ian. You've got a story about how there's more about on this Pluto thing. Haven't we had enough of this?
Yeah, I mean, we had Owen Gingerich from the International Astronomical Union on recently, bemoaning the decision that was made in Prague a few weeks ago now about just casting Pluto out of the planetary club. But now
still calling it a dwarf planet, however, which
calling
is
it a dwarf
planet
and dwarf planet not being a planet. So yeah, we're now down to 8. But that now a bunch of astronomers, 300 of them, have got together and with a petition saying that we as planetary scientists and astronomers do not agree with the IAU's definition of a planet, nor will we use it.
And, nor will we use it.
No, they're
that's
saying a better
threat,
definition.
Isn't it? That's a real threat.
Well, the fantastic thing is that they're going to call their own meeting next year to discuss among themselves what the definition of a planet is. And they're saying that they're going to get on with it. The community will decide among themselves in the IAU. You can catch up when they've
this
decided.
It's just ridiculous. It's like sort of welterweight. It's like different codes of boxing. And it's just ridiculous,
isn't
it?
It's the People's Front of Judea.
It is. It's very silly. Helen, please tell me, do you care about this?
No, not at all.
You work in space science.
But, I've always thought Pluto was a bit dull, as I said a couple of weeks ago. I haven't got into trouble. I mean, either way, who cares?
No, Adam, any thoughts on whether Pluto should be in or not?
I don't think Pluto, Neptune, or Uranus should be included as planets. I mean, they're just so far away.
Oh right, distance is the main thing for you then. All right, well, thanks everyone for all of that. You're listening to the Guardian Science Podcast, and you're really very welcome to get involved. You can send us an email at science@guardian.co.uk, or remember you can Skype us at GU_studio. Now, those of you who listened to this podcast carefully will have noticed that something was amiss with the show 2 weeks ago. I was excitedly talking about my trip to the mountain in Chile to see the Atacama Large Millimeter Array, a huge observatory being built 5,000 metres up in the Andes. But the black art that is podcasting meant that the actual report from Chile somehow disappeared. So here it is, in its full glory. Now, just to remind you, this is extreme stuff. 5,000 metres is not the sort of height that's healthy for humans, and the report starts on the way up to the mountain. This is a member of my party, Stuart, describing how we've been told to prepare for the high altitude.
What they say is that when Jeep stops, we get out of the Jeep very slowly, and then we take three big breaths on the oxygen, and then we walk, but we don't walk at a normal pace. We walk slowly.
So I'm here 5,000 metres up on the Plano de Chatlantour, the Chatlantour Plateau, where the ALMA site will be. It's a landscape that you wouldn't recognise. It's like Mars, completely barren, no life anywhere around here. Walk a bit too quickly and you run out of breath, as you can hear. I'm already running out of breath. I've got my little oxygen canister here. Here's how some other members of my party are feeling.
It's quite a peculiar feeling. You feel a bit lightheaded and almost as if the world's a bit spongy. Maybe if I'd sort of been at ground level and spun round and round and round in the garden like you do when you're children. It's a bit like that. The oxygen really helps. I'm very glad I've got a can of it under my arm.
If you walk quickly or if you try running, you notice a bit the lack of oxygen.
It's like being, well, in a different planet, because you have to walk very slowly. Your brain doesn't function very well, so probably your decisions are not very wise.
The reason I'm standing 5,000 metres up on the Chacnantor Plateau is to talk about the ALMA project. And I'm here with John Richer. He's an astronomer at Cambridge University and the lead scientist on ALMA. John, it's really hard to breathe up here. It's probably impossible to work. Why are you building such a big observatory here?
Yeah, well, that's a very good question, because, you know, what we're trying to do here is build, you know, one of the most complex technological machines ever constructed, one of the most complex observatories ever constructed. And we're on a very, very difficult site. We're on a site which is, you know, nearly the altitude of Everest Base Camp. It's freezing cold, and it's hard to work here. The oxygen level in your blood is only about half what it is at sea level. But we're here because this is a fantastically great site for astronomy. It was discovered about 10 years ago here in the Atacama Desert of northern Chile. And it provides a unique view of space, particularly at the frequencies we're working at with ALMA.
So the ALMA telescope, which consists of basically 66 radio dishes, how is it going to work? What's the advantage of being so high up?
What we're trying to do is use these radio telescopes at very, very high frequencies, okay? And what happens at very high frequencies, this is microwave and beyond, is that any water in the atmosphere absorbs the radio waves that come from deep space. And so to observe the objects we're interested in, we need to find the driest place we can. And this site is amongst the driest ever tested on the whole of the planet.
And what are we looking at when we see these radio waves? Where are they coming from?
Okay, so at these very high frequencies, what we're trying to do is pick up really cold objects in the universe. So these things are only 10 degrees above absolute zero. They're clouds of dust and gas that we can't look at with optical or infrared telescopes. So in particular, we're trying to find new stars out forming, new planetary systems forming. And also, we're going to look very far into the distant universe and find the first galaxies forming after the Big Bang.
You're doing really well talking at this sort of altitude. I mean, even I'm flagging. How are people going to work up here?
Well, you know, let me just take a quick puff of oxygen here, Alec. You know, in fact, what we do is we make sure that people working up here have a good supply of oxygen to make it safe and make their brains function well, so they can think clearly and act sensibly and safely and solve, you know, some of the tricky problems up here. So this observatory will be manned by a small staff of very experienced engineers and technical people, but the astronomers will be normally getting their data from their desks in the UK, in Europe, and we're sort of operating this a bit like a satellite mission. Obviously with a few people in here to make sure the telescope is behaving and maintain it, but by and large what people will get their data, their views of the deep universe delivered to them over computer networks.
Well, that's almost it from us. Helen's got some letters that we're going to read out, though.
Yeah, so first up, we've got a suggestion from David Green in Essex on how to encourage more kids to do science. He says that you would recommend a few years of compulsory lessons in dead languages, Latin and Greek, ideally with grumpy teachers.
Why? Would that help?
Apparently, it's a proven method of encouraging bright pupils to study physics.
Just bore them into
bore them into submission.
Find some subjects that are more boring.
You think this is boring? Wait. What else have we got?
And also, a couple of people have obviously embraced the fact that Pluto is now no longer a planet, and have sent in some new mnemonics for us.
This is the last thing we're ever going to say about Pluto, promise me, on this podcast. Go on.
So Jerry Abbott has come up with, man's very embarrassing mistake just shows nothing's unchanging.
That's not bad.
But it's slightly controversial because Uranus and Neptune have switched around at the end there. And then finally, we've got Jonathan Claydon, who's come up with mailing various erroneous mnemonics, just silly until now.
That's not bad.
It
I like
is,
that.
It is bad, really.
It's no, but it's witty and it's contemporary. It's brilliant.
It's a string.
Have you got
words.
A better one?
Kings play cards on fat girls' stomachs.
What?
That's the mnemonic to remember the phylogenetic order.
Oh, for goodness sake.
Can you remember either of those that Helen read out?
No.
What about the one to remember the 12 cranial nerves?
All right, no, we'll stop there.
to touch and feel... Oh, I better stop.
All right, Adam, well, thank you very much for coming on the show today. You've been very good. And thanks again for your...
well-behaved.
Your preference of us over Rich and Judy. It's always been good. Thank you all for listening out there. And thanks again to James, Ian and to Helen and to Natalie for doing all the sort of producing things. I can never say that properly at the end, can I? All right, goodbye to everyone.
Guardian Unlimited.